Farmers Market broadcast Saturday the 13th.
Yes. And
we're speaking with
Fernanda de Campos. I'm the Farmers Market coordinator. Good morning. How you doing?
Good. Good. How about yourself?
All right.
So what exactly do you do at the Farmers Market here?
Well, this Farmers Market has got a very different model than other Farmers Market. Besides having produce and food vendors, we also do community programming, and we do it to complement the eating healthy, so that for you to be a healthy person, eating is one part, and also physical activity, playing, keeping your identity, and having other things covered are important. So that's what I do.
Oh.
I bring different partners to the market to make sure that we offer things and people will complement their eating healthy with other healthy habits and activities.
Awesome. The market looks pretty packed today. It looks really, really busy. What type of vendors do you have other than food vendors that come to the market?
Yes, we have prepared foods from different ethnic places, from different ethnias. We have Salvadorian and Somali, Bosnian, Mexican hot dogs, popcorn, and Ethiopian today. And besides those, the produce and farmers. And we have Tupperware community member is coming to show people how to keep your food healthy in enclosed containers. And also we have lots of jewelry, people who make their own jewelry, and people who bring things from other countries, from Iraq and from Mexico. And we also have people from Monroe Clark, students bringing secondhand things to sell, but they're fundraising for a field trip. And that's the number of vendors we have. We also have community programming today. I can tell you about.
Yeah, would you please? We'll have a community programming.
We have some students from UCSD coming and telling people about Buy Local, Save Water. It's a big campaign about how if you support your local economy, you are helping the environment, and how you make the connection. So they're walking around the market, trying to engage people to come in their booth and learn the cycle of water and how buying in local farmers and stores is good for the environment. And we also have Fixing the Food System booth, and these are two girls who come and inform also the residents on how you can start your garden and why it's important, and also that your SNAP benefits cover buying seeds and starters so that you can start growing your own food.
That's awesome. That sounds really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So the UCSC students are coming by, they're talking about kind of instead of buying water from the store or having your water shipped in, like Sparklets Man coming and dropping off the water, but to actually use your municipal water?
It's a little bit broader than that. It's they're talking about the fact that, yeah, we do import a lot of the water we use in San Diego, we need to use it better, but also most of the water consumed in the United States, 75% of it is used by industries. And so if the more processing on the food and the more processing on any products, the more water we are using. So we're trying to tell immigrants, this community is composed mainly by immigrants, we're trying to remind them and inform them that if you make your own thing, you grow your own food, or you buy local, you are avoiding a lot of those processing costs and water usage. And also, the local production of food is a lot pesticide-free, and the pesticides in the long term do pollute the water. So if you're buying pesticide-free produce, you are actually saving water because it's not being polluted by fertilizers and pesticides that seep into the soil to contaminate the subterranean water.
So it sounds like what you're talking about is kind of food justice and water justice in general for the community.
Indeed. And so this we've been doing since the market opened, but this is a more official campaign we are running.
When did the market open?
The market has been open for 2 years in June, June, the third week of June third Saturday of 2008. So it's been 2 years.
Is there nonprofit status for the market?
Yes. Well, the farmers make profit, and that's what they're here for. But there's maybe like 8 organizations right now that support the permitting and many of the expenses for the community programming, and that is nonprofit, yes.
So I see that there's a lot of different options for people with different income status, and could you go through some of those options with me?
Yes, we were actually the first market taking EBT, which is SNAP, food stamps benefits in a farmers market in Southern California. The first one doing it in San Diego, and also week checks, and week participants come here to cash it to use their checks for food and vegetables. But that wasn't enough in the beginning, because the produce normally locally grown is a little more expensive than produce coming from other commercial large-scale farms. So the way we are helping that is doing Fresh Fund, which is a matching program. If you are on SNAP or WIC or Social Security Supplement, you can register in the program, and we give you $20 a month so that you can have more access to fresh produce.
That's awesome. So it seems like, you know, these veggies, they cost a little bit more, the produce costs a little bit more, but it seems that you're really paying the true cost, because labor is more fair, it's pesticide-free, that you're not burdening the cost on someone else in the area, that
correct,
you're accepting responsibility for your own food.
Yes, you're right. And that's what the food justice is all about, is paying a fair price, right? Because when our produce or our food is coming from other places, you really don't know what is the cost of that in other countries that are less regulated on labor laws. And also in America, we are running large-scale farming, and we are killing the diversity. Many farmers are having to change businesses because they don't make any money unless you're subsidized by the government. And it's a system that is broken in many ways. And the first step towards fixing it is you understand where the food is coming from, make the right option as a consumer, spend your dollar wisely, and make sure that the people who are growing your food are the people who are getting most of the money, and not the distributors or the big corporations shipping it or changing it.
So like for agribusiness farms, you kind of tend to have a lot more runoff, and the runoff includes all the fertilizers and the pesticides that they use to grow these crops, that they don't really, they don't stay in the topsoil, they just kind of run through, and it actually depletes the topsoil in the long run. They're not adding to it. I read the other day that they're saying we have about 50 to 80 years worth of topsoil left on the planet because of agribusiness.
Yes, and also lawns in your house do the kind of same thing. When you are adding fertilizers or pesticides to your lawns, you're doing the same thing with the soil around your house. And in these places, we're not supposed to be having lawns. And also, I don't know if you learned the fact that you spend 10% more in water by growing lawn than growing a vegetable garden.
So it seems kind of really just ridiculous to have lawns in general then, instead of gardens in San Diego. We're in a desert. If you're water's such a valuable resource, why would you want to waste it on something that you're not really using, such as your front yard?
Correct. I think you're so right on that. We live in a semi-desert area, and we shouldn't be having these kind of things. And if we start working on it, we can compost, make better soil to grow food, and that way we also are becoming more sustainable in the area.
I'd like to bring you back onto the farmers market. How many people work for the farmers market or volunteer for the farmers market?
We have an average of 6 to 8 volunteers for community programming, and 4 or 5 volunteers for Fresh Fund. So basically, the market is run by volunteers. We have a couple of us who coordinate these efforts, and but most of the things are being done by volunteers and interns from different schools, different institutions, who are going through this to learn how to come back in the community and understand what's going on and help. But the volunteers who mainly help me, and that I'm very grateful to, they come from here. They live around the block. and they get they like coming here. They like having breakfast, and for many of them, it's the highlight of the week.
Yeah, it seems like it's a, you know, it's a very happening place. Is it easy to find access for people to, I see a lot of different people, very diverse, so is there any like language barriers that you find? Do you feel any volunteers that kind of step up to the plate that kind of help?
Actually, everybody has learned in past 2 years how to overcome those barriers. We do have lots of children mm-hmm. who help us translate, interpret back and forth with their parents, and so they help in this funny also to draw little pictures and try to see what they're trying to get. But we get volunteers. We try to find volunteers that speak all the languages, main languages that are spoken in City Heights, which are English, obviously, Spanish, Vietnamese, Swahili, and Cambodian. I forgot the Cambodian language name, but we have one volunteer at least of each of those languages helping
in
the different programming. Yeah,
that's really cool. I've seen at the farmers market occasionally cooking classes. Is there a cooking class today?
No, we don't have a cooking class today until the third week of the month.
The third week, every third week.
Please come and join us next week. We do have, it's called Spoonful of City Heights, and we invite residents from the area to come and share their favorite recipes. And we ask them to do it with local, with ingredients bought at the market and that are in season, so that other neighbors are learning how to cook with local seasonal ingredients. And also we try to make it balanced so that it doesn't have a lot of grease or it doesn't have a lot of things that are maybe toxic for other people, and healthy. So we have a lot of fun doing this. Many children like participating in it, and we've been sharing tips on how you make things here and there, and I think it's been a lot of fun. We've been doing it since February.
Would you mind talking about kind of the importance of buying produce that's in season?
Yes, because if it's not in season in the area, then you're bringing it from somewhere else, and how we were saying earlier, the chicken costs and are expensive and combustible and pollution. And also when you're buying food from other countries that you don't know how regulated are on labor, many abuses tend to happen to those people. And also the food needs to be sprayed and kept in, with different methods so that it doesn't ripe.
Kind of chemical preservatives that keep it so it'll last longer?
Correct, yeah. So they spray them to keep them, you know, in shipping, and then when they get here, they spray them so to help them ripe. And that is, those chemicals, we don't really know what the side effects are. They haven't been studied, and I don't think it's natural to be eating all of these things that the nuts from the area.
Yeah. There's no labels on the produce. You really don't know when you buy something at a big corporate grocery store what you're actually buying. Like you say, there's these chemicals they spray on them to preserve them and then to force them into ripening. So this seems to kind of tie into the whole concept of food justice again, that that's another aspect, is buying things that are in season.
Correct, and that way too, you make sure that you're eating the healthiest thing for you and your children. And like I like to add to that not only this food is not labeled, but also a lot of it has been genetically modified, which is hasn't been tested for side effects, and is killing the diversity of our planet, because a lot of this is just being done for profit and the love of growing food for nutrients and for health is not there anymore. It's just being commercial. So, and also GMOs are not labeled, which is another huge problem in the United States. And other countries are labeled, not here.
I always thought it was kind of weird that they're able to claim that GMO is kind of an act of benevolence, but at the same time, you know, they copyright it, so these are short-term plants. They're not meant to, the seeds aren't meant to be usable the next year. You're kind of forced to keep buying that from this company.
Yes, we know the name of the company, and they're doing it for profit, and they can speculate on the prices too for next year when the seed is not usable anymore. Indeed, and also it's copyrighted, and we know that if you happen to be using it by mistake because you cross-pollinated with your crop, you can be in a lot of trouble because of copyright infringement.
I've seen some methods in gardening. They're called the biointensive methods. John Jevons does it. He does it out of Santa Cruz, and it's the Common Grounds community garden there. And this biointensive method was kind of developed in France, and it's spread, and it's been growing over the years, kind of evolving and becoming more efficient. And one of the things they teach is that from the same square footage of land, through proper farming techniques, you're able to produce more and more of your crop. With less and less water, less and less resources. So when we hear like big corporate farms and they say you're able to produce so much food out of this land, we're saving people because we can produce more and more food, we find that through just better education in gardening, we're able to produce more out of the ground with less resources without GMOs.
Correct. That's very right. And you can see that when you go in the Remedy Garden that is here across the street, how people do utilize the land in a more intelligent way. And these are things that they were doing back home. A lot of these lots are for the immigrants, and they were doing it already in other countries. I think an important fact is that here in the United States, we have lost a lot of the traditions because of the commercialization of agriculture. But also you can go new routes and see how vertically they're using the space and how the same water that was used to do the cucumbers is running down for the jicamas, and so they utilize the same water. You can see it happening right there and then. And then people are also choosing what to grow depending on the of the space and depending on the water, and they talk to the neighbors. So a lot of these things are happening here, and the amazing part of it is that it is new immigrants doing this, new immigrants bringing back to us what we used to do in the past.
They're bringing technology by necessity, and yes. It's just teaching conservation to people in general.
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to say about the farmers market in general? What's coming up in the future, in the near future, that you'd like to tell people about?
Well, we're going to be having a big bazaar for Christmas on the third week of December.
Okay.
And also the third week of the month, we'll have aerobics classes here at the market outdoors, so that you can practice physical activity with your neighbor and outside on the street. It's pretty cool. It's full of energy. We also have wellness. The wellness booth is having like a revamp. We have many different activities now for children to teach them about nutrition, but with being fun. And as always, we have, I don't know if you knew, but we have the produce bags, which is like a CSA program, community supported agriculture, into which you can every weekend come and pick up a produce bag for $15.
What does the $15 get you in the produce bag?
Oh, it gets you a lot of good stuff. It's all seasonal, pesticide-free produce from the market, and we have we include a little bit from everybody each week, so to make a complete kind of bag for you. So you have this weekend, you have oranges, tomatoes, onions, eggplants, persimmons, tomatillos, chiles. You have beets, eggplant, and asparagus.
And this comes from all the different vendors, produce vendors. So you're kind of spreading the business around, helping everyone out. It seems like
everybody,
it's a good deal.
Mm-hmm. Everybody pitches in a little bit from their booth, from their produce. We also have eggs, and they're organic, and they're range free. I've seen the hens; they live very happy lives.
That's fantastic.
We also have the eggs and 6 eggs in the bag, and so all the farmers pitching the best of their crops. It's a value of about $20, I will say, and you get it for $15.
That's awesome.
So if you want to come and support your local farmers, come and visit us.
Great. Thank you for talking with me today, Miranda.
No, thank you, Phil. It was exciting.
Thank you. Please introduce yourselves.
Hey, I'm Linda.
And I'm Andres. It's a pleasure to be here at the City Heights Farmers Market.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for agreeing to be interviewed.
No problem.
Is there a meeting tomorrow? How about a little intros about yourselves and where your interest in food comes from, your diet, and your favorite in-season item?
A Okay, I'm Linda. I've been baking since I was 12, like from scratch. And I just started baking vegan stuff a couple years ago because a lot of my friends and coworkers were vegan and I like sharing the stuff I make. So I wanted to be able to make stuff that everyone could eat.
I've tried a lot of your vegan stuff. It's really awesome. It's really good stuff.
Thank you. Oh yeah, and I also used to be a vendor at this market. I'm selling vegan baked goods.
Is there a chance you might come back to being a vendor here?
There's a chance.
Yeah, I'm really hoping for that chance. I have been vegan for the last 5 years, and those 5 years have been quite an experiment. Trying to, you know, veganize a lot of the foods that I really enjoyed growing up to suit, like, my lifestyle. And I've also been baking for quite a while now because I felt it was really important to show a lot of my friends and my family that just because I'm vegan, it doesn't mean that I necessarily have to just eat, you know, lettuce and...
lettuce and lentils.
Yeah, lettuce and lentils. Exactly.
So what's your guys' favorite dish to cook, to bake?
Oh, I like everything sweet. Anything sweet, basically. I don't know what my favorite thing to make is.
What's the dish you're most proud of?
That's a hard question.
Huh. Yeah, kind of. We both bake a lot, right? I think one of the things I'm most proud of I'm still trying to perfect the recipe is I've been able to make vegan flan, which is
it's really good.
Yeah, which is quite interesting to have a vegan flan out there because the traditional recipe for flan is like a bucket full of eggs, so it's quite exciting.
So what do you use as a substitution for eggs and vegan flan?
I use a thickening agent, which is like there's this seaweed called agar. Do I have it correct? Yeah. That you just boil with any kind of wet substance, and it acts as a thickening agent. So after the agar dissolves in whatever I use to boil it with, which could be coconut milk or soy milk or almond milk, it actually thickens it after it cools. So that's what I use.
Is agar inert? Is there like any sort of health benefits of eating agar, or is it just for thickening?
I believe it's just a thickening agent. But when you try to compare it to the amount of eggs that might go into traditional flan, like I'm avoiding a lot of cholesterol and definitely, you know, a lot of that.
It's made out of seaweed, so there's a chance it might have some. What kind of seaweed? I think it's also called canteen or carrageenan, but I'm not 100% sure. Do you have any tips for using it? Because whenever I use it, it turns out bad. I don't think I know how to tell when it's dissolved.
Constantly stirring. Like a lot of recipes that ask for agar, they give you, you know, a little heads up, which would be like stir every 5 minutes or stir constantly during the duration that it needs to boil. And this isn't stir, walk away for, you know, 5 minutes, come back, and then stir. This is like standing over your oven sweating, you know, ensuring that you're stirring this. It helps it dissolve a lot better. What usually happens is that agar will get stuck to the side of the pans, or it rises, and it creates like a thick layer at the top, like this like skin. So that's why it's definitely best to ensure that you stir it as much as possible during its boiling process.
Whenever I use it, it like absorbs all the water in like this crazy thick thing.
Wow.
The recipes are easy, good, I guess.
Yeah, all the recipes I've used in regards to agar have just called for like a tablespoon at the most. So it's really interesting, yeah.
What else have you made with it? I tried to make marshmallows once. That totally failed. And I tried to make a peanut butter chocolate pie. And
wow.
The filling had a strange texture. I didn't like it.
I've made chocolate pudding before, and I've tried to make custard before, like the kind of custard you would find inside of like a cream-filled donut.
Yes.
They both came out pretty good, but since I really didn't know how to make the custard, it kind of came out as that glob of agar and, you know, and sugar. But the pudding actually came out pretty well because I just followed the same recipe that I used for the flan. Just added cacao, which is ground up cocoa beans, you know, and didn't use the rest of the recipe for the flan, so I just made it into like this chocolate custard.
That sounds good. I've only made one good thing with agar now that I think about it. I made like Boston cream cupcakes. They're like vanilla cupcakes with vanilla pastry cream and topped with like chocolate ganache. They were delicious. But it took like 2 hours to make the pudding part. You cook the agar and then you chill it and then you mix it with tofu and soy milk and sugar and vanilla and chill it again for another hour. It's really time consuming.
Yeah.
I think there's an easier way to do that.
So there's this common misconception that healthy food, in particular vegan food, is kind of like bland, not so tasty, that if it's good for you, you know, you're going to be paying for it in the flavor type of thing. We're also, a lot of, you know, kids growing up are exposed to nothing but fast food, and your taste buds come acquired to the fat and salt and sugar. What would you say to people that say vegan food is, in general, healthy food is as bland or...
I just don't think that they've had good vegan food if they think it's bland. Like, a lot of the times when I had my stand, I didn't even tell people that it was vegan until after they sampled it, because if I would tell them beforehand, some people wouldn't even want to try it, because they'd be like, oh, vegan, and, like, they wouldn't even give it a chance.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it's a grave misconception that, you know, vegetarian and our vegan foods aren't delicious and are bland just because of what people associate with those kinds of foods, you know. I think when you talk about like vegetarianism or veganism, everybody pictures this block of tofu on their plate with like some, like, I don't know, like sprout garnish and like a glass of water.
big block of tasteless tofu, a couple of veggies and some water.
And yeah, some brown rice.
Exactly. And unfortunately, like you said, like our children now are raised in a fast food nation, and it's quite unfortunate that their taste buds are now, you know, programmed to associate like, you know, sweetness and what they consider to taste good with like feelings of happiness and, you know, all that. But like, I've had some really delicious vegetarian and vegan foods throughout my veganism, and it's, yeah, there's,
I think it forces you to be more creative. Like, a lot of vegetarian and vegan food, it's inspired by other cultures, so there are a lot of, like, different things that you could try that you might not have had otherwise. That are still really flavorful, like different spices, Ethiopian food, Indian food, Italian food if it's not covered in cheese. Like, there's a lot of delicious stuff that you could eat.
That's not to say that all vegan or vegetarian food is healthy for you either. There's
it's true.
No.
There's fast food vegan. There's things you can buy at the grocery store that are heavily processed, that they may not contain animal products, but they're not necessarily good for you.
Yeah, there is definitely a part of veganism, and especially part of the vegan, you know, food lifestyle that isn't healthy at all. I used to work in a vegan market here in San Diego, and a lot of my coworkers that were vegan weren't the healthiest people in the world. They were more vegan for their ethical standards, more for than their health standards. So that's also a part of it too. Like, that goes into the misconception of like how vegan food isn't delicious, or like there are some really delicious vegan foods out there that aren't good for you. Like my flan, possibly, you know, like it's definitely not going to have the amount of cholesterol that, you know, a typical, you know, flan dish is going to have, but it's still going to have, like, it's still going to be based in sugar and have, like, a cream cheese substitute that I use also as well for, like, a thickening agent, which is also kind of high in fat, but still doesn't compare anywhere close to traditional baking goods.
Yeah, the stuff I made definitely isn't health food. I still had sugar. It was just unrefined sugar. It still had fat in it, but I just used canola oil or unhydrogenated margarine, like Earth Balance. It's dairy-free. So it would definitely be lower in cholesterol, maybe lower in saturated fat. But it's still sweet stuff.
But we're
still,
yeah,
like,
yeah, we're
occasional.
Still talking baked goods.
we're talking desserts. We're talking, this isn't staples, right?
Yeah,
these are
definitely.
People wouldn't be eating your flan as a meal replacement.
Yeah, exactly.
These are occasional treats to have sometimes.
Is there any other tips you would give to people for how to veganize a recipe? What other substitutions are there out there?
Well, there are a lot for eggs. You really have to, like, maybe think about the recipe or look at different recipes if it's your first time, like, veganizing something, to figure out what the egg is used for in the recipe. Because sometimes it's used for, like, holding things together. Sometimes it's used to make it fluffy. Sometimes it's there, like, I don't know, for, like, cream puffs. Like, I don't think you can make those vegan because you need the egg to, like, expand the dough.
Yeah. Sometimes they're even used to, like, add, like, a paste to, like, you know, to your baked good to have, like, this glossy look.
Oh, glazing.
Every, yeah,
true.
Glazing, exactly, yeah.
Could you give me some examples of some substitutions that both of you use to make traditional dishes vegan?
Okay.
Like applesauce, avocados.
Yeah. Applesauce is an easy one. People use that to replace fat a lot too, because you can use the applesauce and, like, reduce the fat in the recipe. Just add, like, a couple tablespoons of oil instead of, like, a half a cup of oil. And it's also used to replace eggs because it adds moisture and it helps, like, the items rise a little bit, makes them cakier. So you could use that in stuff like banana bread. But banana bread might not even need it because of the bananas. And the easy thing is to buy egg replacer. I usually don't use it that much. You can buy it from, like, Henry's. It's a powder mixture of starches that you mix with water. And you can use that in a lot of different recipes. It's usually good if there's only one or two eggs in it, because I can kind of taste it. If there's a lot of egg replacer, I can taste the egg replacer. I usually try to find recipes that don't need egg replacer, that, like, are starting to take into account. Sometimes they'll have, like, plastic in them. You could also mix with water. It's 1 tablespoon of ground flaxseed with 3 tablespoons of water. You mix it until it becomes, like, gelatinous, and that really acts like an egg, but it has a strong flavor. The first time I didn't make anything with flax, I didn't like it. The flax really overpowered it, but I also didn't know you had to mix it until gelatinous, so it was all, like, oily. It was kind of gross.
Yeah, and like Linda touched on, when you try to consider, like, how many eggs you need to replace, like, you have to consider that also with your egg substitute, like, how too much of an egg substitute would make your, you got to consider that your dish is going to end up tasting like your egg substitute, whether it's egg replacer or you decide to use bananas. It's also a really important thing. You could try to make a zucchini bread that calls for eggs, and you will use banana as a substitute, and you'll end up with a zucchini banana bread, you know.
Love. Sounds pretty delicious.
Yeah, it still sounds delicious.
I've never heard of this. You can use bananas as egg replacement.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool.
You can mash it up. Just like I heard you can use avocado. I've never used it because it's pretty neutral and kind of buttery flavor. I heard you can use that too. You can also use tofu, silken tofu, blended up in a blender. It's like a quarter cup is one egg. I think it's the same thing for applesauce and stuff. It's a quarter cup, I think. Not 100% sure. But yeah, you can definitely taste it sometimes, because I've made vegan ice cream a few times, and I made it once with tofu, and you could kind of taste it a little bit.
The tofu?
Yeah.
And also with sugars, too, as a replacement, you could use things like maple syrup, molasses and or agave syrup, which agave syrup would be the preferred, since it has a low glycemic index and your body, you know, digests the sugars down a little bit slower, and like, so it provides a sustainable source of energy to you instead of you having a sugar spike and passing out after you enjoy your favorite, you know, vegan baked goods.
So you're talking about using kind of more natural sugars versus like
processed, like
fructose or something that's not really meant to be a sugar, like a high
fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
When you evolved like corn syrup in your baked goods, there's tons of problems that you associate with that. There's like, I believe high fructose corn syrup releases how would you call it? I believe it's called leptin in your system.
It's a hormone.
Is it leptin?
Enzyme or hormone used in like digestion, or it's kind of like a regulator in your body. I think for fat storage or something like that. There's ghrelin and leptin, and they're like your hunger signals and like say being full.
Yeah, so it throws off your ability to decide whether or not you're still full or not. So what usually happens with people who have high diets in high fructose corn syrup is they just, like, the problems that are associated with monosodium glutamate, like MSG, you know, you just don't feel full. Like, you continue to consume and consume and consume, and which will lead to, you know, high blood pressure, you know, and obesity, tons of issues that are associated with, you know, consuming just more than your basic needs to survive or just to enjoy a meal. So,
also, you need to keep in mind, though, if you're going to use those like liquid sweeteners, you need to adjust your recipe a little bit. Reduce the liquid in the recipe. And I think with agave, you need to lower the temperature by 25 degrees and then bake it for a little bit longer because you lowered the temperature, because it browns things faster.
I'm sorry, if you have a cup of sugar, how much agave syrup should you use to substitute for that?
I think it's 2/3 or 3/4 of a cup. I haven't baked with agave that much, and when I have, it was like with a recipe that called for agave, so I didn't have to adjust anything.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's sweeter than sugar, but I think in the final result, it's not as sweet. You had those peanut butter cookies I made once, right?
Yeah.
You know, the agave ones? Huh? They weren't very sweet, but the dough tasted sweeter than they ended up being once they were baked.
They're wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're lucky and you're looking up ingredients online and recipes, they'll have charts, they'll have comparisons to like how you can replace the sugar with the agave, and I'm pretty sure there are charts online as well to help you decide.
So I'd like to kind of move it to tips for cooking in large quantities. What tips can you offer to people in the market that may have large families or may just want to have a lot of friends over or produce a lot of food at once?
Don't start at the last minute.
Yes, that's a big one. I hate being stressed out, so I need to start like early, because there's so many things that can happen, especially if there's a deadline or if you're like trying to cook for a large amount of people, that you don't want to go wrong. Actually,
yeah.
Val wanted to talk about this, but it's okay. We can talk about it. I would say read the recipe before you start. Like, read it. Make sure you understand all the steps. And check that you have everything, because there's nothing worse than you, like, get halfway through making, like, cookies or something, and then you find out you don't have chocolate. Like, you have to go to the store. Like, super annoying.
Yeah, another thing to, like, also consider is you can't just double recipes in size. Like, I can't have a recipe and then multiply it by 2 and then still bake it at 350 degrees for 45 minutes. A lot of people kind of fall for that misconception.
I fall for that lots of times.
Yeah. you can do that if they were in 2 separate dishes, as if they were being baked at, you know, in 2 different containers. But you still want to keep a close eye on them, whether or not the temperature needs to go up, and then you're kind of experimenting still for a while, because when baking 2 different things at once, which are at the same recipe, the temperature kind of doesn't have to change or it does have to change. So
yeah, sometimes it'll depend on your oven. Like if you're used to baking one pan at a time and you're baking two, it might not like cook evenly, so you might have to rotate the pans like halfway through or something, like just check on them, make sure that like the air is circulating correctly.
So yeah. The reason for this as well, like surface area is one that if you add more volume to something, you have less surface area.
And it's going to take longer to cook, first of all, if it's like twice as thick, you know, it'll take longer to cook, definitely.
Ovens work on convection, and if you're adding more pans to your oven, it stops the transfer of heat.
Yeah.
I think you know more about physics or chemistry than I do.
Yeah.
Take your word for it.
Certainly. Also, don't be afraid to ask for help. I think is a really big thing, and to ensure that your help has not the, I guess I could care less whether or not the people that I ask for help like have experience with baking, but it's a big deal whether or not the recipes are, you know, a half tablespoon of baking soda or a half tablespoon of, or like a tablespoon and a half of baking powder. Like when you go back to like, you know, I mean like it's practically a chemistry, you know, like we're
baking,
playing with these
baking
recipes.
Baking is very different from cooking. Cooking, you can kind of like do whatever you want, adjust the seasonings as you go if you don't like how something tastes. But baking is definitely chemistry. You need to be careful because it's like the baking soda reacts with acid, baking powder reacts with heat and acid. You have to know like how they're going to react, if you even have an acid in it or it won't rise sometimes. You can't just like change ingredients really daily unless you like understand what they're there for.
Yeah.
Would you guys like to talk about how to store / freeze produce for future use?
Oh man, I meant to look that up. If you're gonna freeze bananas, definitely peel them beforehand.
You're supposed to peel them beforehand before you freeze
them? Yes, because I think one time Brian had they had a bunch of bananas. You froze them without peeling them, and then like once you get the peel off, all the little like strands inside the banana were stuck to the banana. Can we get them off? Yeah.
Yeah. You do the same thing with like strawberries as well. If you're not interested in having the leaves, you know, in your smoothie or in your baked goods in the future, then cut those off before as well.
In general.
Also, like, if you're planning on having your vegetables, say if you bought them at the market and you're just maybe 2 days away from deciding on your meal plan, then you can, you know, cut off the ends and put them in, you know, a cup full of water, just to ensure that they stay healthy and they have a source of water to maintain without them drying up or becoming wilted and weak.
If you're not gonna eat your berries right away, don't wash them. Like wash them right before you eat them. If you're gonna freeze them, wash them right before you freeze them. Make sure that you dry them all the way before freezing them. You can freeze them in like a shallow layer, like one layer. Don't like clump them all up together, otherwise they'll get like icy.
So it's kind of the natural wax that these berries produce.
No, wait. If you wash, I'll just wait for that to go. If you wash them like a couple days before you eat them, it accelerates their deterioration, so they'll go bad faster.
Yeah, and also with your vegetables, ensure that if you decide not to put them in the refrigerator, ensure that you're putting them in a nice, cool, you know, shady area, because if they're inside of your kitchen, my kitchen actually has windows, you know, the sun's coming up when the sun rises and the sun's coming in when it goes down. So my kitchen pretty much maintains a pretty like warm temperature. So I always gotta take into consideration like where my vegetables are being placed at throughout the house even. So you wanna make sure that they're left in a cool, dry area so that they don't, you know, become wilted and heat damaged.
So which type of vegetables would you, if you were trying to keep for a couple days fresh, would you put into a glass of water?
Leafy greens, definitely, yeah.
And herbs, too.
Herbs as well.
And this isn't like, you don't want to dip, you just want to give them, probably like 2 inches of water. You don't want to like submerge them in a glass of water because too much water is also bad. And you also want to replace the water every day to ensure that they're getting fresh water.
This sounds kind of like flowers in a vase, but your vegetables in a vase.
Exactly.
In a vase.
Yeah.
Save it for your sweetheart.
What else do you want to talk about, Phil?
Well, I've got you down here for your favorite cookbooks.
Oh, yes. My definitely like favorite cookbook ever is Vegan with a Vengeance. She has like a really good variety of like basic things that you can make and like interesting things that I never would have thought of. Like she has some like Ethiopian peppers, like barbecue pomegranate tofu, like mango tofu, like stuff that I never would have thought of, like flavor combinations that I never thought of. Which I think are really interesting. I haven't been able to make everything from it, but the stuff I've made has been really good.
Yeah, personally, I usually check out VegWeb, because VegWeb has the cooking community kind of uploads their own photos on how, you know, the recipe came out. And so you get to see everybody's creativity when it comes to, like, the recipe, and you're like, oh, wow, I never would have thought of that. Or they upload photos of how instead of using the cake recipe, they used it as a cupcake recipe and just changed a couple things. And they also leave comments on, like, oh, this worked best for me, especially when they consider, we talked earlier about, like, replacing the sugars with, like, less refined sugar, like, whether it's agave or anything, there are comments about like, oh, instead of using 3.5 cups sugar, I use this amount of agave, and this is how it turned out. And then they'll have their photo as well, so you can see like, oh, you know, this person's legitimate. Like,
it's kind of like a community. Like you're sharing like different hints and stuff about each recipe, and you learn by trial, by others' trials.
Yeah. I also really like VegWeb. It's a really good website. It was one of the first websites that I looked at when I was trying to learn about making vegan stuff.
Yeah.
It's really good. You can see, like, also how they modified it. Like, some people might say, oh, it's too sweet, so I reduced the sugar by blah, blah, blah. It turned out fine, and it was still sweet enough.
Uh-huh.
They'll give you ideas, and they might also be like, oh, this recipe is wrong. Instead of 2 tablespoons or whatever, you should use 1 tablespoon.
Mm-hmm. Or they'll say things like, I added mixed berries and it turned it out just fine, or I added mixed berries and my cake turned into like a glob of goo, you know, stuff like that. And it's really great to see that the community working together through that medium via the internet. But one of my favorite cookbooks that I haven't had a lot of time to look through lately is In Search of a Lost Taste by Joshua Pujo. He actually came and did 2 demos lately with Microcosm Publishing at the Snowdrop House, which is like a community house here in City Heights. And what he does, he's practically like a traveling vegan cook. So what he does is he goes to, you know, different cities and into different communities, and he doesn't go to the Walmart, or he doesn't go to the Henry's. He doesn't go to any, like, conventional grocery store. He goes to small, like, mom-and-pop places on the corner, and he sees what you have in your pantry, and he uses whatever is available, essentially, and comes up with these crazy ideas. And his cookbook is available through Microcosm Publishing, and it's actually pretty amazing, the fact that he's been able to just show that there's still life in the kitchen. There's still creativity out there that needs, and there's new recipes to be invented, you know.
He sounds like a MacGyver of vegans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's also really nice. I met him at the Microcosm event, and we had his books at Groundwork Books. So I got to look through it. It's really cool. It has, like, the history of different things, like how things are made, how to process them, like how to cook them, like. It was a really, really cool cookbook. And he also does events in LA a lot. I think that's where he lives when he's actually not traveling. And I wanted to go a few times. He has like these full course dinners where he'll use seasonal items or like have a theme and make all these like really, really creative dishes. like charge like $20 or something, all you can eat, like gourmet vegan food. Really awesome.
The cookbook itself actually is a recipe book and a storybook. So in between, so I believe it's not him, but it's a drawing of him that looks like Hunter S. Thompson, essentially, with like an onion head traveling through, you know, I don't know if it's a different planet, but going through like different layers in this planet, getting closer and closer to the core, discovering trying to get closer and closer to this lost taste, trying to find the ultimate recipe. And as this character discovers these different recipes along on his travels, those are the recipes that are, you know, given to you in the book. So it's really interesting. It's kind of like you're experiencing it as well. So.
Was he also trying to prove that vegan food is not tasteless?
Yeah.
Have you guys ever been on that website, the Post-Punk Kitchen?
Yeah.
I find a lot of good recipes on there that are like pretty quick and easy, but pretty healthy for you at the same time. Full of flavor.
They changed the website recently.
Oh, did they?
I don't like it as much, because before you could have, maybe I just didn't see it, but before it was more like people who went to that website posted up their own recipes also.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it.
Yeah, this, I think last time I looked, it was just like from Isa and Terry. I don't know. I didn't like it as much.
It's a bummer.
Yeah, I've used a lot of recipes from that too. They tend to move towards like more traditional recipes. I think like they have like carrot cake. So if you're looking for like a really simple like traditional baked good, like that's definitely a place to check out. And a lot of recipes are pretty good. I myself made like the coffee cake that they have, which came out pretty good. And tons of other stuff I can't really remember.
The people who do the Post-Punk Kitchen also do Vegan with a Vengeance. Just so you know, and they do vegan cupcakes all over the world, which is super popular, and vegan cookies in major cookie jar. They just came out with like a brunch book, which sounds cool, and a low fat cookbook. I kind of have a girl crush on them, so that's why I know all this.
Is there anything in the upcoming future that's going to be happening, like any sort of baking events that you guys like to talk about?
Oh, I know what I would like to talk about. I want to do a pie potluck.
Pie potluck.
I've talked briefly with Andres about this once, but I think we should do it. Because I went, my friend had a pie day party last March, and I made a strawberry apple crumb pie. She made a banana chocolate peanut butter pie, and her other friend made like a veggie curry pie. They're all really delicious. And I think pie is really yummy.
So both sweet and savory pies.
Yeah, I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah, I think I'd want to try more savory pies, more hearty pies, like a seitan pot pie or something. Seitan is like a gluten, like mock meat for in place of chicken, in case nobody knows what seitan is. But yeah, I think we could work on that. That would be a lot of fun. No pie throwing, though. I'm really adamant about wasting food.
Yes, only pie eating.
Only pie eating.
I'd like to thank you both for coming on today and for doing the radio show with us at the farmer's market.
Yeah.
No problem, Bill.
Yeah, we appreciate it. This is great. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hi, if you're just tuning in or listening, this is the Radio Live from City Heights Farmers Market, and this is San Diego Independent Media Center Radio, and I have with me
Eleanor England. I'm from the San Diego Urban Food Project. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. It's nice here. I haven't never been to the City Heights Farmers Market, actually. I've seen the signs.
It's a cool market, right?
Yeah, actually, it really is. I was eyeing your tamale, actually.
Would you like to try some?
I was thinking about moving in on it, yeah. No, I'm cool. No, actually, I just ate. But yeah, actually, we're I guess I have a group that we've been organizing called the San Diego, sorry, we just changed our name, called the Urban Food Project. And what it is basically a community farm sort of thing, but it is on private property. So, for instance, you have a house with like a yard or something, and you're like, dude, my yard is all gross or whatever, or you can't handle it, or you just want to, you can donate the area to us sort of as a loaner for a certain time period. And then, you know, people from apartments, people from houses, people from, you know, other situations that either do not have access to land or just want to be a part of the project will come over and we'll put in a farming space for you. And then we actually plant up, hopefully, what we'll amount to, we're going for 100% of our food for all the participants. We're working on the logistics of that.
No, but it sounds like it'd be awesome if it worked. It's really ambitious, but it seems like it's going to be really cool.
It's fully ambitious. Yeah, I just did, I just called somebody to verify the land amounts, and it was, I realized, wow, this is really ambitious.
What do they say per person you're supposed to have?
Well, they're saying 4,000 square feet, and they're figuring that on a vegan diet. But not everybody in the group is a vegan. I think we just have one vegan, actually. Even so, with vegans, you need to plant a lot more grain, a lot more beans and that sort of thing for protein and such. But we had a meat crisis a little earlier where we were like, did not know where the meat was going to come from. Meat takes a lot of space to provide. It uses a lot of resources, and that's a little difficult to provide in an urban, limited urban kind of space. But one of our members actually had a sort of a, you know, genius breakthrough and figured out a way to produce a lot of meat, actually more meat than we will probably use. We may actually share it with one of the sister farms in the project. This project's the Mid-City Area Project, but there's also an East City project that's happening too.
So this is using catfish. This is raising catfish.
Yeah, actually it is. He was going for tilapia. He really wanted tilapia. He was talking about tilapia. I think he was like wearing tilapia t-shirts and underwears and stuff. But after a while, he was like, well, you know, this tilapia stuff needs to get like heated to a certain amount. And we talked to a couple people who kept tropical lilies and so forth. And they were saying their heating bill was like $700 like for 3 months to keep it at the target temperature. And we don't really actually have any money, so that was actually somewhat discouraging. But actually, then he kind of went home and he thought about it, and then all of a sudden he had this breakthrough. You know, catfish, 100 gallons of water will produce 10 pounds of catfish in 6 months, and he's got 26,000 gallons in this big hole that we're going to make into a lake at his house.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can catfish, like, I know that tilapia, they can they survive fairly well in gray water. Is that a deal with catfish? Can you reuse some water? Can you reclaim some water for catfish? And it's
I think actually you probably could. We haven't fully investigated it, but catfish, like tilapia, are, and certain other people I could mention, are bottom feeders, and they can actually survive in a fairly, you know, catfish are, they're pretty gross in
pretty
nature.
Murky area, yeah.
Yeah. We're hoping to feed them something that like makes them a little bit more palatable to people. People sometimes don't like them because of the muddy flavor. So we're thinking, how can we not have that? You know, how can we sell them to people who are like eating steaks?
Right. Like, how can we make this fish taste like garlic and lemon?
Yeah. Not cat food.
So this project, you're taking land, or you're not taking land. People are donating land to you, front yards, backyards, side yards, just any parcel of land that they're not really using, and they're hoping that you will grow on their property, share the food, and all the members that grow on the property will also share this food.
I'm sorry?
It helps the members.
So all the members, and including the person that owns the land, everyone shares the food.
Yes, actually, the idea, the hope, for the project is that we would produce enough food so that everybody really has all the food that they need for the time that they're in the project. And that would include the homeowner or resident. It would include the people working on it. It would include the people doing the planning and so forth. And actually, the idea is that the food is communally owned by everyone in the group. So it's not like you put in 4 hours and so, you only get like 3 rutabagas or something, So
we're just kind of happy just to have anyone's effort
to
make the whole thing work.
Yeah, and we've been running it in sort of a very bizarre way, a way that, I always sort of wondered about, but I never really thought about, I wondered if it would be productive, but people are just contributing in the way that they can, in the way that they have the energy, the resources, the talent, the interest, the tools, whatever it is. So for instance, somebody will say, oh, I got this big hole in, like, Jim was like, I have a big hole in my house, my yard. Okay, cool. We need some pond liner. Okay, well, my friend Lisa's like, hey, here's a whole bunch of pond liner, like, for free. And she's not really working too much on the planning, but every time we need a material, I turn to her and I'm like, we cannot find, like, any buffalo-shaped, squeegees or something. And she's like, oh, I know right where there's some. I'll totally hook you up, and it'll be free. And then other people, we have a hydroponics guy who really, really, really knows hydro and aeroponics. And he looks like he's going to be doing some design work for us. Maybe we might have to actually start using some pretty weird growing spaces. So we're hoping that will, some of them probably will have to end up being hydro or aeroponics just because of the space issues.
So that kind of alleviates the concerns that you need 4,000 square feet for vegans, a little less for those that eat dairy or meat, but
actually not really actually true. The dairy perhaps, but the meat actually is extremely space inefficient. I'm not sure. I mean, the catfish is interesting because it's a vertical kind of situation, and actually, yeah, it's deep. So I'm wondering if maybe we can have the catfish and actually float some aquaponics on top of it. There is some talk about that.
Oh, I might feed the fish maybe as well.
Yeah, actually, we're not really sure what will happen with that, but this woman that has tilapia actually has them in something with, like, lettuces floating on them. So we were like, wow, that's interesting. I wonder if we could do that with the catfish. I mean, aren't they, like, looking for gross stuff on the bottom? So.
Right. Well, I'm sure whatever it's growing on top would sink, maybe, hopefully.
Yeah, maybe.
So this idea of kind of using square footage to the most, to the most efficiently, kind of going vertical with your garden, you can hang plants upside down, you can do, like, trash can potato farming,
Yes.
You can go vertical walls, the green walls.
Yeah, we've been actually, there was the setback of the, instead of 100 square feet, you need 4,000 sort of thing. That was a little bit of a bummer. But actually, I was calculating at my house, which is tiny and has probably 200 square feet of growing space, really. I was calculating, well, what if we had some vertical planters along the fence? What if we had some on the large faces of the house, not all the house, but just, along the side or whatever, what we would get, and it's like 1,000 square feet of growing room. And I'm sorry, but if you can get 1,000 square feet of growing room at my house.
What can you pull out? A house that actually has a huge yard, right?
I'm thinking maybe some of these suburban places would be good for, a bunch of space. And I'm wondering, too, we've been allotting 2 days a week meat ration for people to, we kind of averaged out what people seem to eat in the group, and we found that, for each member we'd probably have to provide around 2 5-ounce servings of animal protein per week. But with the catfish, since they're vertical, I'm wondering if some of the carnivores don't want to kind of, like, lean on the fish end of it a little bit. That would actually help. So we'll have to see how it goes. There's so many variables. It's actually just kind of unfathomable, actually. But somehow, actually, because people are really stepping up and they're taking the initiative to work in the, really kind of nerd out in the areas that they're interested in, people are taking charge of different groups and doing lots of research on the side. Actually, it's funny, but like kind of together as a group, this is a very, very powerful force, because they want to, they want to very badly. And I think it, logistically it sounds impossible. I think because of what I'm seeing and the kind of genius breakthroughs that people are making in order to make this project workable, I think there's going to be some very interesting sort of ideas and technology coming out of it, and I think we might actually get 100%. I know some other people don't, but but I have to kind of believe, though, because I'm the person who believes.
So the members of this group, they seem to be varying different political ideologies, but they're all coming together under the same concept that they just want to take their food into their own hands.
Yeah.
Kind of a big stick it to the man thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of stick it to the man kind of people there. What I noticed from being on Facebook, I'm an entertainer, so I have to, when people friend me, I have to say yes. So I end up getting all these like right-wing people on my Facebook page, and I don't know, there's some arguments that go on, but what I've noticed is that when there's no names mentioned, they say exactly the same thing. It's bizarre. Like, they say corporations are taking over, we don't like it, we're getting really screwed up by these forces. They're controlling our government, they're controlling us. We need to be controlling ourselves. We need to have a little bit more power. And that is for born again Christians, as for lefty socialists, it's for any kind of person in between those two people. In fact, I'm going to a big born again Christian shindig tomorrow night.
Yeah,
I totally am. Cool. And the born agains that I met through this are very, very wonderful people. Really wonderful, actually. They weren't really pushing their agenda on me. It was just really, we're talking about goat milk, and we're talking about how we can, how can we grow our own food? How can we cooperate? And there's been so much a division in this country. It's actually really nice to be able to have something that you can actually work on together and start to see that the other person is a person instead of just the enemy.
Instead of us versus them, it's kind of common ground, and it's the food.
Yeah, it needs to be us. And I don't know, maybe them will start to try and mess with us, but I'm not really sure. But if that, then it'll be us, all of us.
Right. There's a meeting today for this project?
Yes, actually there is. It's at 1 p.m. at Lestat's Coffee House at 3343 Adams Avenue, 92116, right at the corner of Adams and Felton, maybe a block from Adams and 33rd Street. And actually, usually the meetings are around about that time at that same location every Saturday. But also, we have some other information on the website and so forth.
Could you plug that? Plug the website?
Oh, yeah, sure. We are in the process of moving to our new domain. But for right now, I have a couple of places that forward to it. The easiest is probably through my website, which is eleonorengland.com/urban-food-network. So it's eleonorengland.com at Urban Food Network, and I spell my name kind of weird, Eleonor. You can also, if that's too complex, it might be, because probably people are diving for their pens right now. We have an email address at urbanfoodnetwork@gmail.com. Or you can, just give me a call, 619-851-3665. And I take text messages, too.
Awesome. I support this project. I think it's a really great thing.
Yes, and thank you very much, actually. It's really appreciate your support.
What I'd like to see, I'd like to have you come back. This is going to be kind of a reoccurring show, and I'd like to kind of just follow the progress of the project.
Love to. That would be really cool.
Hopefully, and yeah. Let it help it grow, help nurture it.
Yeah, yeah. We just got our new, we just got our first, we ground broke yesterday, and it went really well. It's beautiful soil, just really beautiful. So hopefully, you know, next time we meet, we'll have a little bit of progress to report with regard to the actual growing.
This is in City Heights.
Yeah, the first project is in City Heights. We have four properties in City Heights, one in Mission Hills, a couple in Talmadge, one in University Heights. I think we have like about 7 in the mid-city area, and then there's about, we have 10 in the East City area. So it's looking pretty good, actually. You know, we'll see how we have to work it, but definitely between those two groups, between the mid-city and the East City, we definitely will get 100%. But whether we can do it by ourselves in City Heights through Mission Hills is, you know, something we're working for and hope to achieve, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, I wish you luck.
Thank you
for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
And hope to talk to you again.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a break. Hi, and we're back, and I'm talking today with
Rich.
Hi, Rich. Thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely.
So I'd like you, as our last guest, to talk about some food and medicinal foods, things like that.
Okay. So I think the way I would frame it right now is probably in terms of seasons. I think that food is medicine in general. So different food is different medicine for different times for different people, right? And so, you know, we're getting into winter right now. It doesn't feel like it outside here in San Diego. I mean, it's actually kind of interesting right now. We have this kind of really awkward transition of seasons, and so I've been seeing a lot of people with kind of, you know, a lot of people getting sick, a lot of people having kind of like strange temperature issues, you know, feeling hot or feeling, you know, we have these like quick cold snaps, or so people get cold. I think it's probably going to get cold anytime now. And it is getting colder in the mornings and the nights. And so I think medicinal foods, you know, we can just talk about temperatures. At least that's how we talk about it in Chinese medicine, which is kind of what I do. So soup is like the ultimate health food, at least in a lot of Asian cultures. And definitely in terms of Chinese medicine, like soup is considered to be like the best health food, easiest to digest. You know, it's like you get all of your vegetables and stuff, and you toss it in the water and get it all broken down a little bit. You know, hopefully not overcooked too much. How are we doing here?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Better,
is it coming back?
Better, I think.
No. Is it still there? No?
That sounds better, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so medicinal foods, right? So soup, there you go. It's okay. Pretty simple, especially in the winter. You know, I think in the United States, there's, you know, we have this crazy relationship with food, and there's, you know, people are dieting all the time, and there's all these crazy, crazy fads every week, and it's terrible for us to constantly be taking really like crazy, making crazy changes in our diets. I think, you know, do all kinds of yo-yoing, you know, between eating what we think is healthy and then going back to eating, what the junk food that we're used to or whatever. So I mean, I think, you know, we get to know what grows in what seasons. You know, so we're in the winter here, and so we're getting our winter squashes. Those are, most winter squashes are like warming foods. They have a, in Chinese medicine, like every food is given a description as it's got a flavor and a temperature associated with it. And so like most squashes are considered to be, winter squashes are considered to be warming. So
would you talk more about this temperature concept? Is that like foods are supposed to raise your temperature or lower your temperature?
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, if you're feeling cold, you know, you're going to want to look at warming foods. Like the spices are pretty, we're familiar with a lot of the spices, right? Like ginger, cinnamon, cloves, you know, these are all like really kind of common across many cultures, considered to be warming and good for cold weather, right? Foods also have temperatures ascribed to them, and so I mean you can take a look at like you know, salads. You know, they're, when it's hot, you eat salads,
right?
And they have a cooling effect on you. When you eat like a baked winter squash or something, it's really, really nutrient dense. It has a warming effect on you, and so it's perfect for this time of year. You know, everybody has a little bit different constitution. Some people are warmer, some people are cooler, you know, and so you would want to kind of tailor foods to your individual constitution. But in general, for the season, you know, you're going to want to eat warming foods in the winter, and warming teas, you know, your gingers, you know, you're probably going to want to stay away from your mint teas in the winter, that kind of thing. I mean, it's not as dramatic here in San Diego,
right. But,
you know, we do get acclimated to the climate, and however mild the temperature changes are, they still impact us.
I think we had last week 99 degrees at the beach and 6 degrees 2 days later. And
yeah. So that, yeah. So I mean that, you know, we are not separate from the outside environment. You know, we have all of these, we tend to think of ourselves as these isolated beings that are separate from our environment. But if you think about all the extreme, you know, measures that we take to separate ourselves out and to insulate ourselves, to protect ourselves. I mean, look at, you know, air conditioning, heating, you know, the really kind of sophisticated building structures and, you know, insulations and stuff that we use, and the dual pane windows and all these kinds of things. You know, we're not, you know, separate from our environment. And so major temperature fluctuations can kind of wreak havoc in your body, especially if your immune system is kind of low. If you're having a hard time with thermal regulation, you know, all this crazy fluctuating, you know, it's going to have a major impact. It's going to leave you susceptible to catching illnesses, or not just, I mean, you know, in Western medicine, we think of bacteria and viruses and stuff, but, you know, in Chinese medicine, we think more in terms of, you know, drawing parallels and metaphors from nature. We don't need to necessarily talk about a virus or a bacteria. You know, we can just talk about temperature. You know, so like, you can be in the sun all day, and get a sunburn, and you get a headache, and you get nauseous, and that's heat.
Yeah.
You know, you got heat, you know, in your body, and that's an illness. You know, that can be treated with food and herbs. And so, I don't know where I was going with that, but
just so that there's alternative, easier methods to lower your, basically to treat your body as your condition is based on temperature, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I think, you know, it's important for us to recognize that we're not separate from nature, and that you know, we need to pay attention to temperatures, and we can do that with food. and if we build ourselves up, like I'm too skinny. I don't have very good thermal regulation, and so I'm pretty affected by kind of radical temperature changes. But you know, if you build yourself up, if you have a strong immune system, you got a little bit of fat, not too much, you'll be able to deal with the changing of seasons, and because that's actually the time when most people get sick, is changing of seasons. So
I was actually going to segue, since we're talking about health, but into beer and the absinthe. But we're running out of time, I think, on power today.
Okay.
Maybe another time?
Yeah, sure.
Cool. Thanks for coming on. Thank you for dealing with the schedule changes and all the...
No problem. Had a good time.
And we're going to break from that theme a little bit to talk with a bunch of UCSD students who've come here to the market from the Complexity and Culture class at UCSD. And the first person of four who's going to be talking is Joshua. Joshua, welcome to San Diego New Media Radio.
Hi, this is Josh. So I'll be talking about the water issues that we have. All right. According to my research, the water that's available for use that is drinkable is only
3%. 3% of what?
3% of water out of the entire water under Earth. Like 71% of Earth is covered in water, and out of that 71%, 97% of the water is salt water. So that means only 3% of the water is not salt water. But out of that 3%, 2% of the water is ice.
Wow.
So pretty much that 1% is coming, from all this process of elimination. And out of that 1% that's drinkable water, 70% of the water pollutions are from the industrial farms. Meaning that it's according to Environmental Protection Agency, so it's really supported by that. And what I'm trying to make, the claim that I'm trying to make here is that buying local produced foods is eliminating those higher probability of pollution in industrial farms, because in local farms doesn't use pesticides at all, which is healthier in our body nutrition wise, also environment wise. It's definitely better forms of agriculture than our industrial farms. So if we could reduce, I'm not trying to like reduce the industrial farms, but if actually people are start buying more local farm produced fruits, anything that's really local, if that will eventually have effects on the environment, we could save water, we could make the water clear than now. So that was my comment on water and buying local, save water.
Okay. Do you know, do local farms, so you're saying local farms, that you don't have to transport the food from a long distance away? Is that?
Oh, that topic can, it's a totally another topic. I just covered percentage of water that we have that's available and pollution. So most of the water that's available are polluted by the industrial farms. That was my claim to buy local to lower those pollutions down. But there's another aspect of this buying local because of what you just mentioned, the transportation issue, that can Randy can explain that.
Randy's gonna talk about that. Cool. Welcome, Randy, to San Diego New Media Radio.
Hello.
Cool. So, what do you got?
I don't really have a whole lot of facts. I just want to encourage people to get more active and more informed. I know chances are you're probably listening to this on the internet, so go to Google, search composting, search gray water or rainwater, recycling, and just get active. Search for non-toxic home cleaners, and very important, just buy local. Your farmer's market, local farmer's market helps producers get or maintain most of their profits, and it really just helps you, helps your local community, and helps the environment. So do it. That's my simple message.
Okay, cool. Do you have any information about, I think you said you had some information about composting.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
No, I don't, but okay. I will. basics are, you want to do a pile, you want to clear a patch of ground, and you should have a pile that's at least 3 feet by 3 feet. Mm-hmm. You're going to have green matter and brown matter, and you want to break them down before you do it and alternate the layers. But you can definitely get more information online than from me, so I encourage you to do that.
Cool. Do you have a compost heap yourself?
Not yet, no. Okay. But I know I transferred from Santa Monica College, mm-hmm. and we have a huge compost heap there. So I'm very happy about that.
Cool. Are you going to try to organize something at UCSD? Or at
your Hopefully. House? We'll okay. see.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Randy. So who's next?
I'll be around.
We might have to wait just a moment. Looks like Josh has a little bit more information, though.
Yeah, I have comments on the transportation issue, mm-hmm. because if you buy an apple in a grocery store, mm-hmm. The price of the food, the price of an apple you buy, mm-hmm. is contributed, like, all the economic factors that forms that price is not just it doesn't just go to the local economy. Mm-hmm. Like, the transportation of fruits from processors, packagers, distributors, wholesalers, all the money goes out in the process of delivering this food to the local. Whereas if you buy local, mm-hmm. all the profits that farmers make goes right back into the local market, which promotes faster and higher demands in local market. Mm-hmm. So buying local not only save water and your healthier nutrition, mm-hmm. it could also promote economic growth of the of the local area.
So kind of like helping out your neighbors.
What is it?
Helping out your neighbors.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, yep. That's I got a bunch of information, but like it's just, uh-huh. We kind of divided up with different people, but
okay.
other students, but they're not here right now, so.
So should we just give them a minute to come here? Are they headed this way?
I don't know. Where are they?
Okay. So do you want to talk more?
Or in local versus global, which mm-hmm. is, it has the same aspects of, local economy. But, local farming supports the environment by enriching the soil, protecting air and water quality, and minimizing energy consumption. Industrial food production is entirely dependent on fossil fuels, mm-hmm. which, when refined and burned, creates greenhouse gases that are significant contributors to climate change. So not just the water and the soil, but it could also affect some air pollution, and eventually it will bring the climate change. You know what I mean? So here we have Jennifer.
Jennifer, I think, had something she wanted to contribute. San Diego New Media Radio, live from the City Heights Farmers Market. And our next guest, thank you, Josh, is Jennifer. It's cool. Just, you can talk about whatever. It doesn't matter. The one thing we know is there aren't a lot of people listening. our next guest is Jennifer from the Complexity and Culture class. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer, and I guess the first thing I should say is that Josh, my groupmate, just pushed me into this. So I actually have nothing.
I'm sure it was a friendly push.
Friendly, yes. I don't have anything much planned besides the fact that...
Let me just ask you, instead of like talking, we can talk about, you know, water and all that. But let me just ask you, this is your first time to the City Heights Farmers Market?
This is my first time, yes.
What did you think of it?
I really think that I wish that it was more around where I live because I'd want to go here every weekend. Mm-hmm. It's just such an interesting place to be. Like, if I could, I'd like buy my groceries here for sure because around, if I'm just to go buy groceries at like my Vons or Ralph's or something, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have this interaction or this cultural like differences. Going to the farmer's market, it was very interesting meeting people. It was everything about it just seems more friendlier. Like you feel like you're actually a part of a community, which is why I would absolutely promote like going to the farmer's market just to walk through it and see who's there or see what's there to offer actually or what you have to offer to the farmer's market because mm-hmm. it's definitely a friendly community and it's not exactly something that you encounter every single day at school, for instance, or at work even. Like work, it's work, but here there's an actual community, so, and I really like that about the farmer's market.
Cool. You like talked to a bunch of people in the course of like you were trying to educate people about water issues today, and like what was the most interesting interaction you had today?
I think all the interactions in general were interesting because, like you said, I was supposed to educate people on conserving water, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like the people here were educating me on conserving water. And it was just, not just conserving water, just conserving the, like, making your own products, making your own soap or your own detergent and stuff like that. Like, they were telling me different ways to conserve water that mm-hmm. I never thought of, that I couldn't have researched online, mm-hmm. which was amazing. So, and you got to hear their stories. Like, these people, they're just grandmothers or their fathers, or they're just taking care of their own family, but they know all of this stuff, and it's just amazing. You didn't get taught this stuff at school. And so, mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you'd read it in a textbook, but you don't. Not many would apply it to their own natural their life at home mm-hmm. but these people do, and it's not, they didn't learn it from a textbook per se. They learned from word of mouth or tradition or their elderlies, and
cool.
That's what else I really liked.
Cool. So, and you also speak Vietnamese, is that right?
Yes.
Did that lead to any interactions that you might not otherwise have had?
It definitely led to interactions with people that I wouldn't have been able to interact with otherwise. For instance, if I also, not only did I meet people who are Vietnamese, that Vietnamese immigrants, right? So they were struggling with English, but they were already consciously aware about the whole water issue, which is amazing mm-hmm. as it is. But also, like... for sure, I feel like I missed out on the chance to interact with everyone because mm-hmm. I didn't know a certain language as well. So yeah, like the main language here is of course English, but by knowing another language, I felt like I was exposed to a different side of a person as well. So for sure, like this is definitely the place for you if you know many languages, and going here even if you just know English, you'll want to learn more different languages. So it's a great place to expose your kids or something to other languages and cultures.
Cool. That sounds like a great experience.
Yes, thanks. And it's thanks to my professor.
Who could that be? So is there anything else you want to talk about, Jennifer?
Just mainly, like I have been doing the whole day, just to, it's surprising that buying local would help conserve water, because seriously, it's amazing that we're only using 1%, like the whole world have to share this 1% of the water, and really like to waste it, you know? Mm-hmm. What one day when we don't have that 1%, I wonder what would happen. So just by buying from the local farms, to be more aware to save water is just something that I feel that very strongly about now. So, yes. Cool.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you.
Andre. So our last guest of the day, Andre, is having a little bit of difficulty making his way over to the Intermedia studio, but it's going to happen. Come on, Andre. Welcome to San Diego New Media Radio, Andre.
Hi, I'm Andre.
Thanks for coming. You were educating people today about water, conserving water. Maybe you could talk about what you thought of the farmers market.
I think some people go to the farmers market. They don't know the local farmers market can save water. They just go to buy some food or grocery for themselves. But I come here to give them the information to let them know the local farmer markets can help to save water that cause less pollution.
Cool. Did you try any of the foods or buy some vegetables or something here?
I don't buy any grocery.
Okay. Have you ever been to a farmer's market like this before?
This is the first time I go to the farmer market, and I think this is very cool. Yeah.
Cool. What was the most interesting interaction that you had when you were talking to people today?
I think when I talk to some people, they don't know much about English, and I'm trying to, maybe they know a little bit, but I'm trying to try my best to explain what I want they know about the water. Yeah, I think this interaction is quite good.
And did that work out okay?
Cool.
What was like the main point that you were trying to make when you were talking to people about conserving water? The main idea that you were trying to communicate to them.
You mean the way I tell?
Yeah. Like, what did you tell them?
I tell them the first. I give them some samples where the San Diego water come from. For example, the Colorado River and some maybe rainfall or groundwater. So, just give them some this information about the water, and then just tell them to buy local and save water. Yeah.
Cool. You're like a UCSD student, so do you live like in La Jolla or that area, or where do you live in San Diego?
La Jolla.
Have you ever been to City Heights before, or this part of San Diego?
This was the first time.
The first time? What do you think of like this area and the market? Like what was your like impression of it?
Yeah, it's quite good, and lots of different people come here to buy their stuff. Yeah.
So, were you aware like that, like a really diverse neighborhood like this existed in San Diego before you came here? Or?
Not really.
Cool. Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about today?
No. It's cool to come to the farmers market.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone who appeared on our show today. This is San Diego Indie Media, live from the City Heights Farmers Market.